The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
9:29 this Wednesday morning. My guest this morning spent most of his life working as an esteemed botanist and senior curator in the beautiful Natural History Museum in London. But his career took a very grisly turn when one day he answered a phone call from the police. His name is Dr. Mark A. Spencer. He joins us now. Good morning, Mark. Nice to talk to you this morning.
Good morning. It's nice to be talking to you as well.
Well, I think you might be the first botanist I've ever met. I'd love to know, what does the 9, 10, 11-year-old Mark A. Spencer, if you could bring him back to kind of his Christmas days around that, was he looking for from Santa?
Well, actually, even earlier on, pretty much the whole of my life, I can remember thinking, oh, you know, plants, plants, plants. I even dream about plants. I have done the whole of my life. So, you know, books on gardening, you know, back in the 1970s when I was a lad, you know, my family all thought of me as going to be the new Percy Thrower.
I'm just writing down Percy Thrower on my sheet in front of me. He was the Blue Peter Gardener. So we're getting, I think we might be roughly the same age, Mark.
National hero, yes.
Yeah, okay. But, I mean, what was it about the outdoors life? The gardens, the forest, the leaves, the ferns, everything. What was it doing for you?
Well, plants are just a space and a thing of great beauty that you can lose yourself in. So there's the aesthetic appeal of plants, you know. You can just be in a wonderful space and see great colours, great shapes and all those kind of things. And they're incredibly good for our well-being. But, you know, I just find them amazingly fascinating as a scientist. You know, what they do on the world, what they do in terms of ecology and the environment, how they function and, you know, how we depend upon them. So there's not really a thing about plants which isn't fascinating, basically.
So essentially then, Mark, when you finished school and university of Reading, where you did your PhD and studied botany, as I understand, you got what I can only imagine was the dream job. You got to the mecca of botany, the Natural History Museum in London.
Well, we're very lucky because, you know, we've got the Natural History Museum and down the road we've also got Kew Gardens, two of the most important institutions for botany collections in the world. So, you know, I was pretty much in heaven, really. You know, it is quite an amazing experience to walk through those doors of the Natural History Museum, and most of the public see dinosaurs and rocks and minerals and sort of bears and things. But behind those doors, which say private, we have 80 million objects, and I was very lucky to look after a mere 620,000 of them. So it's an extraordinary experience being behind those closed doors and working with amazing people and also with amazing collections.
I often think of the arrogance of humanity when, you know, when we think of the world of botany and 80 million samples just in one building itself. I mean, you know, what for you, Mark, in a given day, as particularly in the museum, going back a little bit, what for you was like a gold medal day? What how did you feel when you punched the air with joy? What did it take for that to happen?
Probably after I'd had my first cup of coffee, that would be happening. But I think one of the great wonders of the Natural History Museum is being able to look at an object which, you know, somebody collected, you know, 400 years ago, exploring a new part of the world and holding something which has not been held by a Western scientist before and examining it and going, wow, this is amazing. This is hundreds of years old and we can still marvel at it and still do science with it. So, you know, I have to say, there's not many things in the shelves of the Natural History Museum that don't tell a tale. They're all amazing things.
There's a touch of the kind of Indiana Jones, but with a better smell off you. I mean, there's a sense that it's like a botanical archaeology almost.
Well, certainly, you know, natural history collections, we think of them as these things that, you know, mad scientists and botanists go out and collect, put on shelves and forget about. But they're much, much more than that. That we can use them to explore all sorts of aspects of the natural world, things like climate change, somewhat topical at the moment, because they are locked in environmental samples in many ways. So it is a sort of internal Indiana Jones in many ways. But it's also very much an external one because we are still collecting to this very day. It's not really a case of sort of Noah's Ark syndrome, where we get a representation and put it in the cupboard. We need to keep on collecting and keep on understanding the world, because the natural world is changing very fast, and the only way we can really understand that change is through more collecting.
Well, let me go then, if I may, Mark, to that, that extraordinary day that changed your life when I think you were at your desk at the Natural History Museum in London. The phone rang. It was a day like any other, except that the person at the other end of the phone was not a typical, I suppose, caller to your desk. Tell us about that phone call.
Well, the phone rang, and I was, my office in that particular office was somewhat grey and a little bit drab. So it was someone like, oh, you know, new colleague going to pick up the phone and speak to them. And it was somebody representing a police force saying, we need your help, Dr. Spencer. Can you help us estimate how long a man who'd been dead lying by a river, how long he'd been dead for? And I was like, ooh. So what do you think I can do? And they were, well, there's lots of vegetation around the man's remains. And we think you may be able to look at the vegetation and estimate how long he's been lying in this vegetation, by the way, the plants are all around him. So I thought, oh, gosh, can I do this? They sent me some pictures, which were, is fair to say, rather challenging.
Yes.
And that was my first experience. And I said, well, I'm going to need to come to the site to actually examine the remains and the vegetation. And so shortly after that, I was on a train heading up to the scene to have my first experience with somebody who had been dead for a long time.
Well, I mean, I just find that fascinating that you'd be sitting there surrounded by 80 million specimens, minding 620,000 of them. And the next thing you know, you're on a train off to a crime scene where you're getting down and dirty with nature and death.
It was quite an odd experience. I must admit, as I was heading up on the train, I was starting to get a little bit of palpitation. And I remember at one point I nipped into a chemist and I bought myself a large bottle of surgical scrubbing kind of cleaner because I was like, oh, this could be very challenging. I'd actually picked up some equipment from a colleague of mine at the Natural History Museum because the museum has forensic entomologists who do similar work, but from an insect point of view. So they gave me a bit of a sort of calming down, it'll be fine, talk to me, and then I get on the train. But definitely your first experience is like nothing else. I remember by the time I'd actually got there, they'd removed the majority of the man's remains, but he was so badly decayed that there was still quite a lot of him there. And I remember there was a police officer who was stood nearby saying this was the worst one he'd had in 17 years. And I thought, there is absolutely no way I'm telling him that I've never, ever done this before in my life. So
Mark? Why not?
Well, I think, you know, one doesn't want to come across green, you know. Okay. You need to instill confidence in somebody.
Okay.
And appearing gauche or naive would have not helped his confidence in my ability to do my job as a botanist. And even though my experience of the human remains was new, my experience of the plants was not.
So there you are on your hands and knees examining, if I may, the remains of the clay and trying to decide, what are we looking at here? Where do you begin as a botanist and that rotting corpse?
Well, the first thing you hope for is that the police have not cleared everything away. I've been to quite a few scenes where the police stand there smiling sweetly going, well, we've strimmed the area around the body so you can get to it. I'm like, you've just chopped everything up into small pieces, which is not good for us botanists. But in this particular case, his body was found growing in a large stand of a plant called Himalayan balsam, which is one of our most serious invasive species. And he had laid down on the ground and had died, and the vegetation had grown up around him. So his body had pressed onto the vegetation that was already there, but the plants were regrowing around him. So I was able to provide an estimate for how long he'd been there, because the police initially were not sure about the circumstances around his death and needed to get a basic understanding of the time frame for how long his remains had been there.
Amazing. And I get the impression, Mark, that you were kind of hooked after that, were you? I mean, something happened.
Well, it is an amazing experience.
Sure.
I mean, I must admit, my emotions were running rather high as I was heading home. But yes, it is an extraordinary experience to work with the remains of the dead and to work with the amazing people who do it full time and all the time. So, yes, I was definitely hooked. There was definitely a little bit of, oh, every time the phone rings from now on, I'm going to be waiting for another call like this.
You talk about this idea of a crushed flower stalk hiding a secret that could solve a case, or a rose bush you brushed past so casually, or the bluebell you unknowingly stepped on, or a spore lodged in a trouser turnip. This is like a Sherlockian detail that would delight people who are interested in crime drama, but it's real life too.
Oh, very much so. I mean, we tend to think of crime drama and forensics as, you know, clearly because it's human beings doing it, as very much a human environment thing. So we often, if you see a crime drama or somebody writing a book, they'll talk about what we call trace evidence,
yes.
You know, little fragments of fibre, hair, little pieces of glass or you things, those kind of things. But whether we like it or not, if we've committed a crime and we, you know, take a body into a wood, or we hide some stolen goods in a wood, or for that matter, we pick up environmental information, whether that's soil, bits of pollen, leaf fragments, all of those little pieces of information, if we collect it in the right way, can provide us with a really, really good understanding of where a suspect may have been.
And you delight in the news that a body or crime scene might involve a bramble.
Well, they're probably my pet plant when it comes to crime scenes and forensics, when it comes to people who've been dead for a while. I mean, brambles are incredibly common, although they're immensely diverse. There are actually about 300 species or so, 250 species of bramble in Britain and Ireland. They're called micro species, and people who study them are called batologists, of all things. But brambles, because they're common and they have a tendency to grow where crimes occur, they can be really useful, because that perennial growth of a bramble, if somebody's body has been lying on the ground for, say, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, the vegetation, in this case brambles, wrap around the person, they grow over them and sometimes through them, and they lock them into that environment. And that means, you know, with a little bit of practice and a bit of patience and some luck, I can look at the stems and the regrowth patterns of the brambles and estimate how many years a person has been lying there.
Amazing. I was reading a book about Arthur Conan Doyle recently, a really good book about him, and how his mentor in university was essentially the role model for Sherlock. And as you talk about what you do, I'm reminded of the mention you give to Dr. Arthur Kohler. And how we leap from botany to forensic to Charles Lindbergh, the famous aviator, and his missing baby. Could you kind of enlighten us a little bit about that 1932?
Well, the Lindbergh case is often referred to as the earliest forensic botany case. And basically, Charles Lindbergh, world famous aviator, his son was kidnapped and subsequently was found dead in a wood. And what was originally a kidnapping inquiry turned into a murder inquiry. And Kohler, who is an amazing wood anatomist and forest scientist, did some beautiful work examining a homemade ladder which was lent up against the home where the child was taken from, and was able to identify the wood mill out of literally hundreds across the eastern United States where the wood came from, and the other elements of the ladder which were made from the roof space from the man who was ultimately arrested and charged and later found guilty for the child's murder. And he was able to basically put the pieces of the treads back into their original positions in the roof of the house, a bit like putting a jigsaw back together.
Honest to God. And he established that the machine tooling on the surface was made by blades rotating at 2,700 revolutions per minute. After inquiries at more than 1,500 sawmills, one was identified as the source of the wood. It was a mill where the chief suspect was known to have worked. I mean, honest to goodness.
It's pretty amazing stuff. I mean, I'm absolutely wretched at maths, and the kind of mathematical calculations he must have had to do to work out the rotational speed, et cetera, makes my poor brain ache.
You had a flutter, as you call it, of emotional disturbance on one case, and you kind of carried it with you a little bit.
Well, I mean, I think people often ask me this question about the emotional environment.
Yes.
And most of the time, I'm very lucky because I do this part time. I can walk away, I can relax and get away from it all. Being in it all of the time, like police officers and crime scene managers are, is very, very challenging. So sometimes there is that sort of stronger emotional feeling where you do feel quite affected by it. You know, I see and read things that would make many of us weep. And yes. So, you know, sometimes it can be a little bit too much when you hear the particularly dreadful things that some people do to others.
But you also, I think at one point you came across a victim and you went, God, that looks eerily familiar, albeit yes. mistakenly.
Yes, there are times when I think, you know, that reminds, you know, reminds you of potentially of family and friends and those kind of things, you know, which is, you know, is not nice, frankly, you know, and knowing these things, when it reminds you of things about your own personal life, mm-hmm. it brings very much to the fore that these bodies in front of you, this body is so much more than a body. It is the last remnants of a person's life. And there are family and friends feeling very, very, very lost and very and full of grief. And that is it's a strangely connecting experience. I don't become angst-ridden with this desire to sort of solve the case, so to speak, and because I'm aware of the fact that I'm part of a much larger puzzle. But you feel quite strongly emotionally engaged with the person and their life and what's happened to them.
As we are on, what are we on today? The 11th of December. Mm-hmm. This is a busy time for you. You talk about the peak season of your work, which is kind of, it's dark, but it's true.
Yes. Well, one of the odd things about it is that is actually in the UK, there's not a strong seasonality in murders and crimes of that nature. They tend to happen pretty much through the year evenly. Mm-hmm. But one of the odd things that happens is that we tend to find bodies more frequently in autumn and winter. And there are two main reasons for that. One of which, well, is that actually people see human remains, usually in woodlands or hedgerows and ditches, more easily. But the other thing is, you know, their dogs, which scatter around, dog walkers in particular, they respond much more clearly to seeing a dog going, oh, into the ditch and the dog reacting. So an owner will follow through with a dog if they can see something. So because we're visual animals as opposed to scent animals, those visual clues become a lot easier for us to see. So there is definitely a sort of autumn, winter and early spring peak for finding dead people.
As we've been talking the last 20 minutes, I am just filming that Sunday evening drama on BBC One, where you are the character based on you in like an Inspector Morse type programme. It's kind of beautiful and grisly at the same time. The botanist detective. Is this happening? I mean, it has to happen.
It would be nice because, you know...
Even the title of your book, Murder Most Florid, that's the TV show. Like, I've made it in my head.
Well, you know, it would be nice. I mean, you know, you touched on beauty. You know, the natural world is a beautiful and wonderful place. And, you know, whilst death in these circumstances is tragic, you know, the biology of what happens to us after we die is extraordinary and amazing. And it is a fascinating place to be as a scientist, but it's also a really wonderful place to be as a human being helping families and friends and the dead.
I'll give you one last comment because I'm a regular enough to the Natural History Museum here in Dublin, and I've been to the one in London a few times, but I tend to head straight for the gorillas and, you know, our simian friends and so on. I tend to go right past all the botanical things, and that's being honest with you, but I have to say, after our conversation this morning, I need to rethink that. But tell me this much, as somebody who knows nothing about botany, really nothing, even though I do love nature, what mm-hmm. should I be looking out for if I was to go to my Natural History Museum? What should we as Irish people?
Embrace your wonderful botanical heritage.
Sure.
You are so lucky. You have the Burren, you have Kerry, you have some amazing mountain systems. You know, you've got some extraordinary and unique plant life. The Burren in particular, I think, would be my fantasy botany area for Ireland. It's an extraordinary place where Mediterranean plants meet Arctic and montane plants. You have extraordinary natural heritage when it comes to plants.
Yeah, there's this beautiful road called the Sky Road in Clifton, Connemara. Do you know it?
I have not been. I've been to Kerry, and I've been around. I've got friends down around Derry Nanway and all down there. And I've got friends in Dublin, so I'm going to be very cheeky and say, hello, Mo.
Yeah, tell Mo you said hello.
Hi, Mo.
Is it
she's
a he or she?
Listening.
She? Oh, good. Well, you can't let it go without saying hi to Mo. But on back to the Sky Road, the reason I mention it is because I would often walk from, say, the town up that road to a place I might be staying. Mm-hmm. And along the way, I'm always struck by what can only be a microclimate. You'll know what I'm talking about when I say what looked like Day of the Triffid style rhubarb growing at 18 feet from the ground. You know, it's like something I don't know.
That will be the dreaded gunnera, which is a South American plant.
Is it?
It was introduced into gardens, and it is emerging as one of Ireland's more serious invasive species because it is out pushing out some of your native vegetation. It's a bit of a burly beast.
Well, there's like campaigns here about the rhododendrons. People, a city slicker thinks they look beautiful, but people living with them are going doing their nut.
Well, the area around Killarney and what's happening with the rhododendrons, you know, you hear about stories about people getting lost in them, but the natural heritage of Kerry and that area of far southwest Ireland in terms of your oak forests and the amazing plant communities down there, your strawberry trees, are all imperiled by this rhododendron, sadly.
The Office of Public Works, a great department here in Ireland, would have just texted to say, we'd be delighted to welcome you both to the herbarium at the National Botanic Gardens here in Glasnevin. Yes. It has 800,000 species and an expert team of botanists. Now, I went there for the first time, to my shame, about 2 years ago, and it was one of the most beautiful experiences I've ever had.
It's a top place, yes.
Yeah. And there's nothing like an afternoon spent walking among plants. As you well know, mind you, that's probably a busman's holiday. You probably hate that.
No, I have, you know, my family and my friends and my partner, you know, they have got long used to the fact that I'm virtually incapable, even in central London, of walking in a straight line without bending over and looking at a weed in a crack in a pavement. So I find joy in plants wherever I am on the planet.
I don't doubt it for a minute. Mark, it's been really good to talk. Happy Christmas to you and yours, and thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you for inviting me.
Congratulations on your book, Murder Most Florid, Intriguing. It's Inside the Mind of a Forensic Botanist by Dr. Mark A. Spencer. That is, if ever I heard a good one for Christmas, that's definitely has to be on the list. It's 10 to 10.